Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you drop the birth rate of an entire country by more than 60% in half a century without a hint of government pressure? And how would that demographic shift change the quality of life? In 1960, the fertility rate in Brazil was 6.3 children per woman, and the average Brazilian citizen had just over 2 years of formal education. By 2009, the birth rate had fallen to 1.9 per woman, and educational attainment had nearly quadrupled. So what happened? Journalist Cynthia Gorney is here to talk about that. Her story, Birth of a New Brazil, appears in the September issue of National Geographic as part of the magazine's year-long population series, 7 Billion. Cynthia, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
The real miracle here is that there has not been a single law passed in Brazil designed to limit family size. And in fact, there's not even a deliberate campaign to have parents choose smaller families. Why are today's adults making such different decisions than their parents and grandparents?
Well, it might come as an odd remark to an American listener to say there hasn't been a government campaign, and they might say, well, there has been no comparable campaign in the United States either. But it's got to be remembered that unlike the United States, Brazil is almost entirely Roman Catholic country, although there are multiple religions there. And it is a developing country for sure, and it has made the U.S.-style fertility drop happen in about one-third of the time of the U.S. So The countries that might more logically have been compared to Brazil in this regard would be India and China, which famously had coercive population drop campaigns that had very negative consequences for some people, although in China, at least, they did succeed in dropping the fertility rate. That's an important thing for people to think about when they look at Brazil. And the thing that was fascinating to me about studying the Brazilian fertility drop, which we did as part of a year-long series the National Geographic has been doing called 7 Billion, which is examining aspects of the fact that the planet's population this year is expected to hit 7 billion. This phenomenon has taken place in many countries in the world, and the reason that it's especially interesting in Brazil is that, for a variety of reasons, Brazil keeps great statistics. They just have a tradition of this. And the phenom, as you said at the very top, has happened without government intervention and very dramatically in Brazil, all over a country that is not uniform, that has a number of big states like the U.S. with wildly different populations. They're different racially. They're different in terms of class, rural, urban, and so on, and yet the drop is uniform all over the place.
Yeah, I think that's another really interesting fact, that unlike in the developed world, the trend has not been led necessarily by middle class and wealthy families. Even people in the favelas are having fewer babies.
That's correct. When I got there, the demographers who have studied this quite closely within Brazil, it's been of great interest to international demographers as well, said, people think if you go to the middle and upper classes, even here in Brazil, people will say, oh, yeah, well, the poor people are still having enormous families. But when you actually look at those numbers and go out and study them, it's not true. Of course, there are still some large families in Brazil. But in the main, the numbers have dropped almost dramatically among the poor and in rural families, as they have earlier, but still among the middle class and upper class women.
So urban migration plays a role in this. As Brazilians move in greater numbers from farms to cities, they no longer see a house full of kids as necessary to earn a living.
That is true. There's a couple of different aspects to that that I learned while I was there. First of all, Brazil industrialized rapidly and very intensively. This was the industrialization and urbanization, a very direct government intervention effort that took place when, in an effort to bring the economy into the modern era, there was a campaign nationwide, come into the cities, industrialize, and so on. Part of that campaign was not, therefore, have smaller families, but a couple of things occurred when that took place. First of all, when you bring your family into the city, if you're a rural family, you are living most certainly, because you came from a poor area of the country and you're going to be even poorer in the city, you're living in a place where you're smashed into very close quarters. Mm-hmm. Your kids don't have a place to run around. You have fewer places to sleep, and very likely the mother in the family is now working in a job that does not, like a rural job, let her come in and out of the house and keep an eye on the kids while she's working very hard all day. She's going out to a factory, so she's gone. And that was one of the things that caused people to start dropping their family size. Second was that people figured out very early on that education was a real key to being able to get a job out there somewhere, and that you were going to need a job, not rural life, to be able to do that. And in order to educate your kids in Brazil, despite the fact that there's a nationwide public school system, every family that can possibly do it tries to get their kid into some kind of private schooling. Because Brazilians in general, I didn't meet a single Brazilian who had anything good to say about their public school system, regardless of class. So that's number two. Number three, there was a phenomenon that took place in the U.S. as well and in every country of large families in the country that was partly that people wanted more hands out in the fields. You needed them to help you work. And that doesn't become the case when your kids are not going to be field hands, but are rather going to be in school. Now they're not adding, they're not contributing to the economy of the family. They're a burden. They're an expense burden. So for that reason, also, you want to lower your number of kids. Fourth, I forget where I am in the list. There's a pretty good list of this. Infant mortality statistics began to drop rapidly as Brazil improved its health system. So one sad part of this whole demography thing in the past was that people used to have larger families out in the country because they assumed, if you had 10 kids, you assumed that three or four of them were going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were shooting for a family of somewhere between four and seven kids, it was not uncommon in my interviewing of people to talk to persons of middle age whose even parents and certainly grandparents had had as many as 16 kids. And they would say, well, I had 16 and 10 of them survived, or I had 12 and 8 of them survived. To a woman of you know, my middle age and demographic, the idea of being pregnant 16 times over 25 years is just unfathomable. But this was really common out there, and part of the reason was that you wanted to have enough kids to hold you in your old age and help with the farm, and you assumed that there was going to be a loss of at least a third of them. And then finally, with regard to the specific rural-urban switch, Brazil adopted a reasonably comprehensive system of social security for the elderly. So people no longer felt compelled to have kids who were going to care for them in their old age because the state was going to help do that as well.
Hmm. How did Brazil reform its healthcare system to the extent that more children, was it a matter of healthcare or was it a matter of hygiene and public services?
Well, they weren't aiming, from all that I understood, talking to demographers and physicians who were, some of them old enough to actually have watched firsthand this transition. Again, the healthcare system wasn't reforming with the specific aim of bringing down the number of kids. It was reforming in all the ways that if you have, my personal prejudices in this regard are going to come public here, if you have what most countries except the United States have, which is a national healthcare system that aims, that has as its aim the overall health of all of the citizens, you're looking at all kinds of broad, widely regarded health statistics. You want to bring down maternal mortality, you want to bring down infant mortality, and so on. And they have had pretty good success as they've industrialized and modernized at making sure that these clinics and medical facilities are available to people all over the country. There's a second phenom, which is really interesting. All over Latin America, which is where I have certainly traveled the most when I've been reporting outside the United States, and this is not, I'm saying, a good thing, but it is a phenomenon. Pharmaceuticals, what we regard as things that ought to be given only by prescription, mm-hmm. are widely available. It's still the case that in much of Latin America, you can walk into any sort of a drugstore and you can buy off the shelf things that you need a doctor's prescription, thus the expense of a doctor visit for in the U.S. So Brazilian women have had access without the costly intermediary work of a physician to birth control pills, which have not been all that popular, sterilization, a particularly interesting Brazilian phenomenon, which of course provides a permanent means of birth control, mm-hmm. and for a very interesting historic period of time in Brazil, not so much the case anymore, abortion pills, medical abortion. So they were able to, regardless again of class or where they were in isolation from doctor facilities, have a better access in certain ways, if not necessarily a safer access to the kind of medicine that allows women to drop their family size.
It is interesting, Cynthia, that in a country where the population is still overwhelmingly Catholic, that even the most devout Brazilians appear to be more than happy to ignore the Catholic Church's proscription on artificial means of birth control.
That is true. And I talked to lots of Brazilians about that. And the main thing that I heard was, it's hard to express this on radio, it was a shrug. If you can envision a kind of affectionate shrug of a person of faith, mm-hmm. it was not the hostility to church teachings generally. It was like, yeah, I'm Catholic, I go to church, I like my priest, and some things my priest is right about and some things my priest is wrong about. Hmm. My priest is not going to get pregnant. I heard younger women in particular, who certainly described themselves as Catholic, and they were not, you know, lapsed Catholic or anti-Catholic, just saying, yeah, the priest wants to have 9 kids, he can go have 9 kids. Right? I'm not going to do that. That is not my life. And I go to church, and I go to Mass, and so on. So there is a kind of selective, affectionate view toward the Catholic Church that I saw and heard expressed at numerous different levels of class among modern women. When I talk to, the story opens, for anybody who's looked at it, the story opens with my conversation with a lady in her late 80s, mm-hmm. who has had an enormous passel of kids. And when I asked her why she'd had that many kids, part of her, she just looked at me like, this is a woman out in a smallish town out in the country. And part of her response was, well, that's what the church said you did. And part of it was just, that's what we did. You know, everybody had that many kids.
We'll talk a little bit about the number of tubal ligations that are performed in Brazil. Nowadays, as more and more women have C-sections, doctors are more than happy to earn a little extra cash by taking care of the delivery of the child and the delivery of permanent contraception at the same time.
Well, this is a particularly Brazilian phenomenon, and it's a little complicated. It has to do with the way that they ran their public health system for a long time. But the shortest way to explain it is that because of the things that were allowed in the public health system and the things that were on paper not allowed, women figured out very early on that it was really easy to, while you were in the hospital giving birth, say to your doctor, look, I know that this is supposed to be against the Brazilian medical ethical code, but this birth is being paid for by the public health service, and therefore I want you to sterilize me right now, even though I know the public health service won't pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a combination of a financial system set up to do that, doctors who are very receptive to doing it, and there's also, just for reasons I never fully understood and no Brazilian was quite able to articulate to me, at least not in the way that I got, there's a general comfort with, first of all, surgery in Brazil. Women are very comfortable with plastic surgery. Not that it's not popular in the U.S., but plastic surgery is more kind of widely accepted and talked about in Brazil mm-hmm. than it is in the U.S. Surgery in general, there is a form of, we might want to call it vanity, I guess, the idea that you have a cesarean because it's going to make you more beautiful. It's going to make your sexual experience more pleasurable for your husband later on because you won't have had the stretching of the canal.
Mm-hmm.
Those topics of conversation, which are still a little bit eyebrow-raising in much of the U.S., are very common in Brazil. So it was just done in a way that we don't really... Tubal ligation, as it turns out, is much more popular in the U.S. than I had understood, but we don't tend to talk about it. And Brazilian women would do that with each other. One of the stories I tell in the article, which really fascinated me and spoke to the way in which Brazilian women would past information has to do with abortion.
Hold on,
after the break.
Thank you very much for setting up the break. That's exactly what I needed to do. Journalist Cynthia Gorney is with us. Her piece, Birth of a New Brazil, appears in the September issue of National Geographic as part of the magazine's year-long population series, 7 Billion. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is journalist Cynthia Gorney. Her article, Birth of a New Brazil, appears in the September issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And deftly, before the break, Cynthia, you set us up for a story about abortion, which does, in most cases, surgical abortion is not legal, even today in Brazil.
Yeah, there are two really interesting things I learned about abortion when I was there and preparing to go. One is that American women in particular of the right age will remember when in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the idea of abortion by pill in the form of what we first called RU486 was first introduced to the U.S. It was a big deal. The pills had been manufactured in France. France, the company had stopped making them. The French government had forced the company to go back to making them, declaring the pill the moral property of women. They were controversial in the U.S., but they arrived, boom, all at once, and we learned about it. Before this whole kerfluffle brought the pill to our attention in the U.S., Brazilian women on their own, with no national publicity whatsoever, had begun figuring out that the medication in RU486, which was originally an ulcer medication, was an abortifacient. It's not clear how the very first word spread, but there were several academic studies that I learned about in Brazil indicating that somehow women had got the word. It was pharmacists reading the labels closely or something, and then they began passing the word to each other. Again, remember that these medications are available over the counter because of the pharmaceutical system there. And word of mouth, they start telling each other, this is how much you take. You're going to start bleeding at such and such a time. This is when you go to your doctor. Don't take this much. And don't take it too late in your pregnancy. And the Cytotec abortions, the medication was called Cytotec, and the Cytotec abortions were a big method of birth control, population control, among women who were very, very anxious to keep their family sizes small, particularly in urban areas. Finally, the government and the church both got wind of how widespread this phenomenon was and did various things to make that medication much less accessible and restricted basically only to people who really had ulcer problems. But the fact that this was so popular to me was a real indication of how adamant the women themselves were about restricting their own family size, not because anyone had told them to do it or because it was somehow being forced down their throats by political family planning type people. So that's number one. The second is abortion, as in much of Latin America, is illegal in Brazil except in cases where the mother's life is in danger and in certain other very unusual circumstances. It doesn't matter very much. There are abortion providers of varying quality all over Brazil. Any woman in any community knows how to get to one. And one of the interesting phenomena that I observed when I was getting ready to go there is that as part of my trying to get back up to speed learning Portuguese, I was watching a Portuguese soap, a Brazilian soap opera. They're called telenovelas, and they're the Brazilian versions of the very, very popular telenovelas that any Spanish speaker knows about on American TV and all through Latin America. These are also very much tied into the population issue or the family size issue in ways that we'll talk about in a second. But the telenovela I was watching had as one of its 9 zillion subplots a teenager who had gotten pregnant, was desperate, and had gone on her own to an abortionist in the cities, and she gets a terrible infection, and she goes into the hospital, and she almost dies. So you think this is going to be one kind of a message, right, a social message about the perils of going to an abortionist. But what ends up happening, it was fascinating to me, the mother or one of the relatives of the girls goes to the abortionist, who is clearly a bad person. She's doing it out of a back room. There's a dog running in and out to indicate that the procedure is very unsanitary, and she screams at the abortionist, "You almost killed my child." And the abortionist in this soap opera, right, we're talking national TV, very articulate, says back, "It wasn't I who almost killed your child. It was you not teaching your child how to use contraception properly and not explaining to her the consequences of sex and not setting her up so that she could actually talk to you about what was going on. That's why she came to me. It's your fault, not mine." And that's clearly the message, right, that this soap opera was leaving the audience with. So it's a very complex matter. And just as in the United States before the national legalization of abortion in 1973, it is very clear in Brazil that if you have enough means and are a woman of middle or upper class and know your doctor, it's very easy for you to go and have a pregnancy termination regardless of what the law may say.
You mentioned 9 zillion subplots in that Brazilian telenovela that you watched, and that also, in a really accidental way, has played into people's perceptions about the ideal family size.
Yeah, this is so interesting. There were early academic studies that really caught people's imagination, and there's some debate about the extent of the influence of telenovela plots on family size, but nobody doubts that there is some influence, and it works in two ways. The first thing is that in Brazil, the telenovelas have a much greater role in social conversation even than the novelas do. If you live and work in the Spanish-speaking community in the U.S., and you watch, say, Univision, which is one of the main networks, mm-hmm. which I know a lot of your listeners probably are aware of if they don't actually watch it, there's usually one or two big telenovelas whose plots are a kind of a national topic of conversation. So, and these are prime time evening. They're not really comparable to U.S. soap operas or daytime television because lots and lots of people are watching them. In Brazil, this is happening nationally all over the country. It's a little bit like people who are old enough to remember the plot of Dallas or any of the big, big shows that are on now. And what academics figured out was that in the telenovelas, they're always aspirational. They're a lot cheesier than a lot of our shows, although we certainly have no shortage of cheesy shows. And there's always 5 plots going on, and one of them always involves families that are roiled up in some fashion. And there's always, almost always, a wealthy family and a poor family, and the wealthy family has all the aspirational stuff. They have the nice cars and the really nice clothes and the haircuts, and they live in a lovely house in the city. And if you're poor, the idea is that's what you want to aspire to. They always have small families. Mm-hmm. They never have a ton of kids. And that's been true for a long time. And one of the veteran demographers in Brazil, who herself is in her 70s, I believe now, whom I spoke to when I was there, said, yeah, we studied this early on because we were really interested in it politically. We said, are you trying to bring down the family size by deliberately making these families small and aspirational? And the writers of the show said, no, it's just too hard to write plots when you've got 9 kids going on. And also, of course, you have to hire all those actors.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you remember, if you're writing a telenovela plot, there's 5 or 6 plot lines going on, and everything involves, you know, the brother who's cheating on his wife, and then there's another thing, and there's something being stolen, and there's a business mess. So you have to keep these plot lines straight, and they're nightly, so it's very complex. So it's a lot easier when your family has 3 kids, but everything about those families in Brazil, including, unfortunately, to this day, the skin color, because although Brazil is theoretically a raceless society, it's an intensely racially conscious society in which the vast majority of the really poor are black and the vast majority of the really wealthy are white. These families are almost always quite light-skinned, with a middle-toned skinned or a dark-skinned person kind of thrown in there for political correctness. But that also adds to the aspirational nature of these things. There's one other part which is super interesting that I hadn't appreciated until I went to Brazil, which is that electricity, a military coup basically ran Brazil during the 1960s, often in extremely brutal authoritarian style, and one of their express missions was to haul Brazil rapidly up into the 20th century and make it an economic force. One of the ways in which they did this was they brought electricity en masse to enormous parts of Brazil that had never had electricity before. It's as though the entire modernization of the Western states that in our country took place over 50 years had taken place over like 7 years or 5, right? Mm. And with electricity, bang, simultaneously came television.
Mm.
And television came in the form of O Globo, which was the big network that brought exactly a certain kind of programming into homes. So what you have in some, it's not that much of an exaggeration to say that overnight you get electricity, one big television network with one big set of telenovelas, all of which, and advertisements, right, all of which are teaching you this is what you want. You want to have small families.
Hmm.
In addition to which, as several people pointed out a little bit cynically but probably truthfully to me, all of a sudden there's something to do in the evening in your house besides making more kids. People are sitting around watching this new thing, which is television, and the population rate goes down.
Yeah, even the idea that keep looking after the kids you already have is an impediment to watching whatever shows you
want to
watch.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's
right. I want to talk about educational attainment because this is really amazing, too. In 1960, women had an average of 2 years of schooling. Men had about 2.5. Today, women have 8.6 years. Men have 7.3. Has that had an impact on the age at which people become parents for the first time?
It certainly seems to have. From the conversations I had with women at all class levels, it's very scary to make national generalizations, like
sure.
American women are this or English women are that or whatever, but Brazilian women are tough. I mean, and they will tell you that. They are the first ones who will tell you that. Life is not particularly easy for Brazilian women in any way. There are regions of the country that have very high rates of domestic violence and anti-women violence of all kinds. But you will hear all over the country that women, when they set out to do something in Brazil, they do it. And the realization that education was going to be the key to advancing one's own interests and the interests of one's family came early and powerfully to Brazilian women. So everybody I talked to, when I would talk to women who were middle class, like in their 30s, I often would have this conversation in which they would say, I don't have kids yet. I definitely want kids. I want only one or two. Mm-hmm. I do not want the 19 like my grandmother had, because I want my kids to have the things that I think are important. I want my kids to have decent clothing and a private school education and decent health care and a cell phone. We're not talking about excessive material belongings, some video game stuff by comparison to what U.S. kids have, very modest. But this is really important to me, and the way that this is going to happen, I know, is that I'm going to stay in my educational setting, whatever it is, and I'm going to get the best job that I possibly can.
Is it safe to say that Brazilian women are driving all the decisions when it comes to family size, or do men watch the same soaps and tend to be of like mind?
Well, I think that's a tough question. Mm-hmm. You certainly don't hear a lot about a massive rush of Brazilian men going to have vasectomies.
Mm-hmm.
The physical decisions that are made about family size, just as in the U.S., it must be said, tend to rest with the women themselves. They're the ones who get sterilized. They're the ones who decide that they're going to take the birth control pill, which is not nearly as popular in Brazil as it is in the U.S. They're the ones who decide that they're going to stay in education or hold off even getting married. On the other hand, you certainly don't hear in Brazil of there being some big conflict between men and women over this issue. It's not like there's some movement of men saying, get back to the house and have 10 kids. Let's remember, it is Brazil that has a woman president, not the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when the elections were underway when I was doing my reporting, and it was fascinating to me that Dilma Rousseff, who is now the president of Brazil, she was the leading candidate when I was there. And nowhere in the discussion and argument over whether she would make a good president was I reading, she's a woman and therefore she can't be president. I'm not saying that conversation wasn't occurring somewhere in Brazilian households. I'm sure that it was. But it was nothing like the conversations that were occurring here about Hillary Clinton and all about her womanness, not about her politics or whatever. And one of the leading candidates in opposition to Rousseff was another woman, a senator, who, again, was being discussed in terms of her politics and were we ready for that party and did she have enough experience, but not are we ready for some kind of a final that's between two women. Oh, my gosh, won't that make Brazil look odd? That conversation was not happening in any sort of big public way when I was there.
Well, and it seems sort of obvious that it would be interesting for young Brazilian women to have female role models who don't define themselves at least primarily or entirely as mothers. They may be mothers, but they have other things going on as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You don't, again, I'm always very uncomfortable with these kinds of national generalizations about men and women because it's so easy to find examples where that's not the case. But when I would talk to women, they sounded very much in transition. Here's what we think is important. Getting an education, raising a family in a modest way so that they also get an education and get as far as they possibly can in life, having some kind of domestic and material happiness, but neither, as in the sort of more vocal and early days of the women's movement, rejecting altogether the notion of conventional marriage, nor maintaining some notion that it's always the woman's job to be subservient to the man and so on, and that the man will make all of these decisions. It's not, there is no women's paradise on this earth, and Brazil, I don't pretend for a moment that Brazil is one of them. But the conversations really had a somewhat different tone, particularly when, as we tended to be, we were talking about these matters of family size. There was a kind of pride, a phrase that I kept hearing. I heard it first from a young working-class woman in a very poor neighborhood, and then later from a woman 69 years old who had had a sterilization, was a fábrica está fechada, which means the factory's closed. I am no longer a baby factory. Mm-hmm. I will have the number of children that I and my mate want, and we will have them when we want them, and then I'm done. And that's why, as I said earlier on in our conversation, one of the things that was interesting to me was that talking about sterilization and having been sterilized seemed to me, as an inquiring outsider, to be a much more comfortable and casual conversation than I've certainly ever heard it be here in the U.S.
Is sterilization as common in single-parent households as it is among women who are partnered?
That's a really good question, Chris, and I do not know the answer. Mm-hmm. I didn't talk particularly to women about that.
You mentioned earlier that the public school system in Brazil is really leaves a lot to be desired. Will that have to be fixed before Brazil can move beyond even the sort of specialized status of being a BRICS country and into the fully developed world?
I would assume so. It's a kind of a flip situation from what we have in the U.S. now, which is that what everybody said, I was in three different regions of the country. Remember, like the U.S., as I said earlier, Brazil is enormous, first of all. It's almost 200 million people and huge geographically with states that are very, very different from each other, as different as Alaska is from Florida in the U.S. And so I was in three different regions in the southeast and so on. And when we get back, we can talk more about what I learned insofar as I was able to, about the educational system there.
Journalist Cynthia Gorney is my guest. Her article in the new September issue of National Geographic magazine is called Birth of a New Brazil. It's part of the magazine's year-long population series, 7 Billion. If you want to join us, give us a call. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Cynthia Gorney. Her article, Birth of a New Brazil, appears in the September issue of National Geographic magazine. If you want to join us, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Cynthia, in addressing this question about reforms needed in the Brazilian education system, you were going to tell us about different geographic regions of the country?
Well, what I was actually starting to say is that we have a reverse, in some ways, of the situation that obtains in a lot of the U.S., where every place that I talked to, people in general were very critical of the public school system and said, you only send your kid to the public school if you absolutely can afford nothing else. But that applies through high school. And the reason you want to send your kid in Brazil to a private school up through high school is that the best colleges and universities are the public ones. So it's a kind of upside downing. I mean, I happen to live in a state with what, at least until recently, has been an excellent public university system, California. But it's a little different from the way that we have traditionally done it here, where in some states, at least, the very best colleges and universities are regarded as the private ones, and you save up for that. I am sure that continuing to improve their educational opportunities across class is going to be really key to Brazil's ongoing economic future.
Has a change in demographic patterns this rapid in the country caused any kind of a sort of cultural generation gap between people who think you ought to have 10 kids and people who think you ought to have two?
You know, I didn't hear the kind of either disappointment or contempt that you might expect going in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
with regard to that, but we did talk a fair bit about it. And one thing that was interesting was there was a note in almost every conversation I had of a little bit of distress over how material-oriented the new Brazil with its smaller families is. Now, this was from people who would immediately say, I don't want to have eight kids and have a simple life the way my grandparents did. I definitely want my kid to be able to have a cell phone and be able to play video games sometimes and have new clothes now and then. But at the same time, there was a sense of where are we going here? Everything, another phenomenon that's relatively new in Brazil, much newer than it is in the U.S., is financiamento, which is putting things away on the payment plan, right? And so if you walk into a Brazil mall, you'll see it would look to a jaded American mall shopper's eye like, okay, this is just your garden variety, mid to upscale, modestly upscale mall. But to a Brazilian, this can in some of the cities be a relatively new phenomenon. And there's all this stuff everywhere and incredibly fancy clothes. I was interested particularly in the stuff available for the kids. And you'd walk into stores where everything was like these beautiful garments for children, and everything's available on layaway. You can buy your kids tennis shoes on layaway if you're a family that doesn't have enough money to be able to afford a pair of tennis shoes. So the advertising is absolutely out there beating on you. Your kid wants tennis shoes. I walked out. At one point, I was going to have a coffee with a bunch of young, professional-ish women, all of whom either had no kids or were planning to have very small families if they had any kids at all. And across the street, I walked into just a random drugstore, and I bought all the magazines for new parents that had to do with kids. And there were 12 of them on the stand, right? And the lady selling me the magazines was more like in her 60s. And we just looked at each other and started laughing. And I said, was this true 20 years ago? And she said, no, I don't know what these people think they need all this instruction and advertising for. You just have the kids, right? So we went over and we sat down at this table, and there were about 10 women who gathered. This was a regular coffee they liked to have. And they were all poring over these magazines, and they were fascinated by the advertising because at the same time they said, ooh, look at that. I'd love to decorate my kid's room like that. And then another one would say, come on, that's ridiculous. That's so over the top. You don't need all that stuff for your kids. And the argument I sensed, and I did hear this in other parts of the country and other class groups as well, was a very complex one, just as we often have in the United States. You want things for your kids, and at the same time, you love to roll your eyes at the parents down the block who have just gone crazy with the incredibly fancy party and the $350 stroller and the over-the-top stuff.
Yeah, right? Like, I'm not raising monsters, but everybody else is.
Exactly. It's not even I'm not raising monsters, it's I'm not crazy in my notion of how you raise good children, but everybody else is, right? So these are the things, this combination of satisfaction, aspirational longing, and a certain sense of alarm or despair about where all of this is going. This conversation is not, I would say, different in Brazil than it is here, but it's newer, and that makes it more intense.
Is that competition among, you know, mothers in particular that we have wrung our hands about in this country starting to rear its head in Brazil?
I'm sure that it is. I don't think I was, to be fair, I don't think I was there long enough to really get a sense of that. But the young women that I talked to in particular definitely talked to me about being uncomfortable about their relations or their friends going over the top with either decisions they had made about their kids, as I was saying, material stuff they were buying for their kids, or that kind of thing. I was not in on, although it really wasn't the main question that I was asking, the kinds of big arguments that we tend to hear so much about in the U.S., about do you stay home with your kid, do you go out and work, do you work part-time, are you ripping yourself off, are you ripping your child off, that kind of ongoing hand-wringing that we've been doing here collectively for 30 years or so, I wasn't privy to there. That certainly doesn't mean it wasn't taking place.
Were you able, Cynthia, to assess how kids are doing in Brazil? Are they thriving?
I don't know that I could answer that well. It wasn't really the focus of what I was looking at, and I think that's you're going to find those health statistics varying enormously, as they do here in the U.S., by class, by city, by state, and by racial group, whether people are rural or urban. It just depends enormously.
So obviously, even in a small family, crushing poverty is going to take
a toll. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And to be quite clear, just as you have, there's still a tremendous amount of poverty in Brazil, and that poverty certainly extends to families that are small as well as families that are large.
Did you hear any discussion at all about women thinking about the impact that multiple births have on their figures?
I had heard that in Brazil. I didn't hear it so much, and I don't honestly know whether that's a trope about Brazilian women,
uh-huh,
that they're more worried about their figures than American women. There's not as much obesity in Brazil, for sure, as there is in the United States, but if you read through the women's magazines, you'll certainly see plenty of articles about diet and exercise regimes and so on. It is said, as I was saying very earlier in the program, that there's a heightened sense, and nobody looks askance on it, of vanity, mm-hmm, among a lot of the Brazilian women. But I think that is a phenomenon of the middle and upper middle classes. I mean, you're certainly not seeing people who are poor saving up their money so that they can get plastic surgery.
Right. Well, you and I would certainly hate to have American women judged according to our magazines, not National Geographic, but
surely
fashion magazines.
Mm-hmm. Surely we would.
Are other Latin American countries in particular looking at what's happened in many ways by accident in Brazil and thinking about ways to strategically make it happen where they are?
I don't think that is the case. That's the phenomenon, the Brazilian phenomenon is unique in certain ways, as is every country's, I guess, in its particular combination of the rapid military industrialization, the weird public health system, the nature of Brazilian women, and so on. But the fertility drop, there are certainly parts of the world in which this dropping fertility phenomenon has not occurred. For example, in some of the countries of Western Sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the reasons that Brazil interested my editors at National Geographic as part of their world examination of population is that the phenom is not a Brazilian one. The fertility stats are changing and dropping in most of the world. Brazil's drop is a little more precipitous than a lot of other countries. They're down to 1.9 now, which is, I don't exactly understand why demographers do replacement rate at about 2.3. I guess that accounts for infants dying, but
mm-hmm,
it's a little bit below replacement rate. But there are a lot of other countries in which this is happening as well, and although, of course, I wasn't in those countries to study them up close, many of the same phenomena explain what's going on, a combination of increased education for women, improvements in the healthcare system, industrialization and urbanization. And also, let's not forget, one phenomenon we haven't talked about at all but was quite impressive in Brazil, as it was here, is the arrival of the women's movement,
mm-hmm,
and the whole notion of a national, international conversation about changing roles of women and the idea that women can be police officers and the president of the country and factory workers and so on, that they have a much broader role to play in society than simply as the mothers. And that conversation, of course, is taking place in a variety of forms, even, dare I say it, in Saudi Arabia. But it's certainly taking place in other parts of Latin America as well.
Are people looking at this issue in Brazil having any concern, saying, well, look at Japan and look at Italy, and there the declining birth rates are a source of really serious concern?
Yeah, I asked a lot about that, and the answer seems to be not yet. Because
mm-hmm,
if you look at the curves, right now they have what they refer to as a demographic dividend, right, which is that they have a lot of people right now in the working age who are there to support their bulge. If you were to try to track this out on some kind of a visual graph, their bulge is in people between the ages of, say, 40 and 60 who are working hard,
mm-hmm,
right? So they have a lot of people who are the ones able to make the money that support the elderly and the young.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that somewhere in Brazil, right, there are people in economics offices looking into the future and worrying about what happens if the rate stays at 1.9. Right now, when the demographers I talked to responded to this question, they tended to say, look, the important question right now is not so much what's going to happen 40 years from now if we don't change our birth rate. The important question is what we do now with the resources that we are able to develop at this moment. If we don't put the money that we're making as a BRIC country into improving our own education system, if we don't improve our own public health system, and if we don't make sure that the jobs we create are long-term sustaining jobs, then we're going to be screwed in another, whatever it is, 10 or 20 years or 30 years. But their concerns were really much more toward infrastructure development than they were toward some fear that the population changes themselves, the demographic changes, were going to get Brazil into trouble.
Do a lot of Brazilians tend to live in multi-generational households?
I don't actually know the answer to that, certainly more than in the United States, but that phenomenon also seems to be changing. And there's definitely not a really buried-in tradition the way there is, for example, in India or some other countries of families living in multiple generations. And this also is a phenomenon of whether you live in the city or in the country.
Sure.
I have to say that in all the households that I visited, ranging from poor to wealthy, there was only one among poor families where grandma, daughter, and baby lived together. And this was a situation where daughter was a teenager, and although her boyfriend was in the picture, they were both a little too young to get married. And that gal also had shut down the factory.
Even as a teenager. It would be interesting, and I know it's not in your story here, but to look at, will the roles of grandparents change in future generations?
Yes, and I think they will. Mm-hmm. I think they will. And there is a sense of whether people, if you're the grandparent of 18 kids, you've got sort of a full-time job description going, and if you've only got four or five kids, you have a different role to play in society. And also, if you are looking for your own sustenance toward, instead of your children taking you in or taking care of you, you're looking to the state and some kind of a pension from your own job to take care of you, now you've got a situation more like ours. And as we know, there are many aspects of the way that our society in the U.S. attends to and cares for its elderly that are not particularly attractive. What happens in Brazil remains to be seen.
Do you imagine that abortion will remain largely illegal in Brazil?
I believe that it will, unless they have a dramatic change. To my knowledge, there is nothing in the books right now en route in Brazil to do a big change in abortion law. There certainly is a movement for legal abortion or better access to abortion in Brazil, but it's a small one. And part of that obviously has to do with the influence of the church. There is a very strong pro-life movement in Brazil as well.
Journalist Cynthia Gorney's story, Birth of a New Brazil, appears in the September issue of National Geographic. It's part of the magazine's year-long population series, 7 Billion. Cynthia, it's been such an interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.